on BBC Radio 4, The Archiver, which this week takes impartiality to an extreme, as on this public service network, Sean Street tells the story of the pioneers of commercial radio, their heyday and their tussle with the BBC, in God, Pirates and the Ovaltinis.
This is a programme presented by the makers of Ovaltine, especially to the League of Ovaltinis.
Actually, no, don't worry. This is still BBC Radio 4, and the charter hasn't changed. Well, not yet anyway. But still, many of today's generation of radio listeners can't recall a time when there wasn't a choice between public service broadcasting and the commercial sector. Actually, legal land-based commercial radio came late to Britain, October 1973 to be precise. But in reality, commercial radio has been a vital impulse in British broadcasting from the very start.
I remember I used to listen in England to these curious stations, and I always remember Bellito Pure Silk Stockings. I always remember these things. It's curious how you pick up and retain these catchphrases. It shows the power of advertising, I suppose.
You are listening to the signature tune of Vernon's Pools of Liverpool.
Vernon's Pools are here again. The crowd begins to cheer again. A win on Vernon's Pools, and the happy days are here again.
Poor Geraldo introduces his next tune, I've Got Something I'd Like to Say. Remember, this is Elevenses with Geraldo and Diploma. I hope you're enjoying it. And you will enjoy Diploma cheese also. The flavour is so perfectly delicious. The reason is, it is genuine English cheddar, ripened and matured in the very heart of the Cheddar Valley.
Hurrah for Vetox, what a delightful smell. The stuff that every self-respecting grocer has to sell. The price is right and cooks delight how easily it's made. So join the happy members of the Vetox Brigade.
Of course, children of the 1960s still hark back to the swashbuckling days of the offshore stations, the Pirates, Radio Caroline, Radio London, and many, many more. Then there are those that recall nostalgically listening to Fabulous 208 under the covers at night, to Dan Dare, Pilot of the Future, and learning how to spell Keynsham, that's spelled K-E-Y-N-S-H-A-M, during the Horace Batchelor Infrared Draw Pools Method show. Before that, there was the war. And before that, well, it was the BBC, wasn't it? Starting in 1922 as the British Broadcasting Company, becoming a corporation in the late 1920s, and remaining a monopoly all those years. But then take a look at all those pre-war radios with their glowing dials and hundreds of exotic faraway station names. Ljubljana, Poste Parisienne, Radio Juin-les-Pins, Madrid, Normandy, Toulouse, and, yes, Luxembourg.
Where'er you'll be, on land or sea, for spoken word or melody, tune in.
Keep tuning in. And if you want the latest news, or if you want the new reviews, you turn a switch and simply choose, out in the open or right in your home, tune in.
In fact, the first scheduled commercial broadcast aimed at the United Kingdom predates the birth of the BBC. A Dutch engineer, Stringer Itzerda, broadcast a series of soirée musicale to Britain in November 1919, funded by Dutch and English benefactors and publicised in the Illustrated London News. Even the BBC in its first incarnation was commercial. It was run by a consortium of radio set manufacturers, keen to provide content to make their new technology of use and value and develop an audience, a bit like DAB and other digital platforms today. And in the very earliest days, there were even experiments with sponsored programmes on the BBC. But then, in March 1925, came a spark of real competition. A fashion talk, sponsored by Selfridges, was broadcast in English from the Eiffel Tower. Apparently only three listeners reported hearing it, but what is known is that the man behind it was one Captain Leonard Plug. There never can have been a more appropriate name for a radio entrepreneur. Plug. Or Plooge. He was of Dutch extraction, a former captain from the RAF in the First World War, and an engineer on the London Underground Railway Company, but with a vision for not the railways, but the airwaves. This story belongs in a way to two men, John Reith, who became the first BBC Director General, and Leonard Plugg. Keith Wallace is Plugg's biographer and has researched his life and colourful times in intricate detail. Plugg's interest in the possibilities of broadcasting began when he was given a radio set, and he quickly became obsessed with a passion for the new medium and its commercial possibilities.
Within 2 years of that, he became known as an expert on international broadcasting, purely because of all of his efforts of recording all this information down. He wrote articles, and he wrote a lot of articles for the Radio Times and Wireless World for the BBC. There was a Clear Band of Ether was one, and you know, what station is that? And he also became, I think it was the president of the Radio Society of Great Britain, amongst other things. He then decided, after having listed all these stations, that it'd be a good idea to actually go round and meet some of the people and visit the stations. These visits he'd made, of course, had put him in contact and made friends of probably the most important people in all the radio stations in Europe. So he had a great deal of influence, because he'd also got the copyright to publish all the programmes of these different stations, which he did, and this was put into Wireless World and publications.
So was it also put into World Radio?
It was put into World Radio as well, yes. All the information on the programming schedules of the continental stations were put in to World Radio by Plugg.
Which is a,
but he wasn't credited with, necessarily.
But that's an extraordinary irony, isn't it, that here's the BBC licensing this man to do all his research for him and put it into a BBC publication.
Right. Oh, this is true. This is true. Of course, by that time, Reith didn't really, you know, sort of realise the threat that Plugg would become.
But some people in the BBC were beginning to show concern about potential commercial competition. An internal memo dated the 5th of November 1929, signed Foreign Director BBC, reads...
This move is definitely one of hostility to the BBC and should not be countenanced.
But at the end of the memo, written in freehand and thought to be by Reith himself, are the words...
My reaction is, why worry when 10% of our listeners are affected? Are we so afraid of competition?
Well, that attitude was to change, as several box files of BBC memos stored at the Written Archives Centre in Caversham bear witness. By 1930, we encounter Plugg again, testing out another device he was interested in, the car radio, while driving through France. Stopping in the Normandy fishing port of Fécamp, he met a director of the Benedictine distillery there, Fernand Legrand, who had an interesting sideline, broadcasting on the wireless.
Legrand told Plugg that one evening he was broadcasting, and he mentioned the name of a friend of his who was a shoemaker in Le Havre, and what good shoes he made, and his sales increased enormously. Of course, Plug's ears pricked up at this, and thought, wonderful, this is just what I'm looking for, a commercial radio station. And so he thought, well, I'd better do something, and he rushed off down to Le Havre to buy some gramophone records. And before he could buy them, he had to go and get some money, so he went to the English bank in Le Havre, the National Provincial, and to draw his money to buy some records. And drew some money, and while he was there, he was talking to the teller, and he said, do you happen to know of anybody who'd be prepared to go to Fécamp on a Sunday evening and put on a few gramophone records? So the chap said, oh, he said, yes, he said, I'd be rather interested in doing that myself. I've got a motorbike, and I could, you know, drop over there and do it for you. So his name was William Evelyn Kingwell. And he was really the first disc jockey. He was certainly the first disc jockey from Radio Normandy. And he carried on for a few weeks until Max Steniforth arrived.
I was desperate for a job, and I answered an advertisement in the Daily Telegraph from Captain Plugg, and I went and saw him, and the result was that I got the job of running Radio Normandy. He sent me over there with instructions to do more or less what I thought best, with a box of records. I would go to the microphone and announce that here was IBC now starting its nightly transmission for listeners in England. And I would say straight away, we are starting off our programme tonight with the popular foxtrot, Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries, or whatever it was. And off we went.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't be so serious.
Max Staniforth from a Radio 4 programme, The First Pirate. This was the real beginning of Plug's IBC, the grandly called International Broadcasting Company. Its first premises were here, in Hallam Street, at number 11, under the girders of the then-emerging Broadcasting House. That address has since been swallowed up by a post-war rear extension to BH, itself now replaced by a vast whole of a building site from which is slowly emerging a new 21st century digital BBC. The close proximity between the two was to become almost a metaphor for competition. Radio Fécamp became Radio Normandy. It was a small beginning which quickly developed. Many names who went on to become familiar household friends via the BBC after the Second World War had their first chance on the continental stations, among them Bob Danvers Walker, recorded here in the early 1980s for Searching the Ether, a feature about the early days of music radio.
Putting on hand-wound gramophones, no less. And we would have to put these breakable 78 RPM discs on, and away we would go during our transmission times. Well, the success of these things was so fantastic. The south of England was our stamping ground. People would tune into Radio Normandy because that was when people used to, what they used to call, search the ether. This was twiddly old knobs of their set and pick up stations from all over the continent. And the better the set, the further they could range. So that when they heard these English programs, particularly as the BBC was not on the air, they would tune into these things like crazy because we put out the kind of things that Radio 1 now and local commercial radio puts out ad nauseum, all the pop music from beginning to end of our transmission times. But of course we did expand, and in no time at all, from those earliest beginnings, grew literally an empire. Now, ultimately, during the time, the 9 years I think it was that I was there before the war killed it, I was responsible for installing and establishing commercial radio programs from 9 different stations. Well, now, apart from Fécamp, there was Toulouse. They sent me down to the south of France to open up on Toulouse. There was Poste Parisien in Paris. There was Radio Lyon. There was then the Spanish circuit opened up in 34, just before the Spanish Civil War, because I was there 2 revolutions before it, in Madrid. And that is a hairy-chested moment, I don't mind telling you. So there was Radio Madrid, San Sebastian, Barcelona, and Valencia.
But what made these stations so increasingly popular as the 1930s progressed? What were they providing that domestic listeners couldn't get from the BBC?
Well, Reith felt he had very strong views on what should be broadcast and what shouldn't be broadcast, particularly on a Sunday. To him, Sunday was the day of rest, the day when he went to church services. And the thought that somebody should be polluting his broadcasting area with dance music on a Sunday, that was only in a Sunday evening to begin with, he didn't think that was right.
Sunday was the most significant day, the day the shortcomings of what became known as the Reithian Sunday policy were truly exposed. That policy demanded that entertainment was not permitted on the Lord's Day. And you only have to browse through a few editions of the Radio Times of the early 1930s to see how true that was. Here's the Radio Times from March the 28th, 1930. On the Sunday regional programme, we have 5 to 5.30, Religion in the Light of Philosophy, episode 13, followed by a religious service at 5 to 8, and the week's good cause, and then the news. And it doesn't get much better as the decade goes on. Here's the Radio Times entry for Sunday, the 7th of April, 1935. For the children, Joan and Betty's Bible Story, followed by Heroes of the Free Churches, episode 10, George Fox of the Quakers, and then Treasures of the Bible, episode 6, How to Read an Epistle. It doesn't get much more lively than that. Contrast that with some of the programming that was going out on the commercial stations, which even had their own radio journal, their own listings magazine called Radio Pictorial. Looking through it today, it's a bit like looking through Hello or OK magazine. It's got photographs of women with legs. And here's one with Helen Mackay, the sweet red-headed crunette who tells us what love did to me. Couldn't be more of a contrast. But we need to put that BBC Sunday policy into context. The late Desmond Hawkins, who after the war was to become a distinguished controller of the BBC West Region and founder of the famed Natural History Unit, remembered in an interview I recorded with him during the early 1980s what it was like to be a child on Sundays between the wars.
People talk about the Wreathium Sunday, and the BBC was very stuffy and all that. But it wasn't just Wreath by any manner of means. There was a very firm Puritan, Sabbatarian culture. And I'll give you one quick example. When my father took the family down to Torquay for a summer holiday, my brother, who was older than I, we both liked playing games, and we stayed in quite a nice sort of guest house hotel type of place at Torquay, very much in the tourist business after all. And on a Sunday, we thought we'd have a game or something or other. And we looked round for the croquet, well, the croquet hoops were in the lawn. But we had difficulty finding the box with the mallets in. We then found it was padlocked, as it was Sunday. And so, well, we thought we'd play what in those days we called ping pong. There was a ping pong table in the building. There was the table and there were the bats. But unfortunately, there was not a ping-pong ball to be found. Now, we were there paying for a holiday, and these people were in the holiday business, but it wouldn't have been worth their while in some ways, with many of their clients, if they had allowed us to play croquet or ping-pong on the Sunday. Now, you see, I'm sure you have to see that ethos to understand the opportunity that the commercials had given them in a way, because the thing was moving rapidly.
Captain Leonard Plugg's IBC became increasingly a thorn in the flesh of the BBC during the early to mid-1930s. Firstly, there was the name, IBC-BBC. The similarity frequently fooled listeners. And even the bureaucratic documents and logos were stylistically similar. When the BBC started the Empire Service, Plugg responded with his own IBC Empire Service on shortwave from EAQ Madrid. And in 1933, the IBC had started its own children's club, with Plugg having the temerity to offer the BBC membership.
My dear Plugg, the corporation is sensible of the honour which you confer upon it in your enrolling it as a member of the International Broadcasting Club. But as it is felt that it would be undesirable for the corporation to avail itself of the opportunity of joining in special club broadcasts or request programs, and as the facilities for the announcements of children's birthdays and golden weddings appear rather personal than applicable to the corporation's needs, it is considered that the corporation should not stand amongst your enrolled members. In thanking you, therefore, the card of membership is nevertheless returned. Yours sincerely.
Who wrote that letter, we don't know. The BBC signature is conveniently illegible. But the IBC didn't have it all its own way by any means. Radio Paris was doing the same thing under the auspices of the rival Wireless Publicity. Stephen Williams, a pioneer from Radio Normandy, had moved to Paris, and Wireless Publicity persuaded Christopher Stone, one of the BBC's most famous presenters, to leave the corporation and join them too. In 1932, Arthur Burroughs, the BBC's first director of programmes, and by this time secretary of the Geneva-based International Broadcasting Union, wrote to a former colleague in the corporation,
I spent the afternoon listening to the European broadcast programmes, Radio Paris, Christopher Stone presenting. I heard two programmes of gramophone records sponsored by an establishment in Brixton Road. A more disgusting display of musical depravity could not be conceived.
Springtime and the young men fancy like eternal love. Springtime and the young men can see skies of blue above.
Happy is the day when the heart is young, the heart is young, the heart is young. Happy is the day when the heart is young, no matter who you are.
Save your business from the rocks, drop a little line to box.
Happy is the day when the heart is young, la 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 la.
Christopher Stone speaking. I know you'd like to hear the rest of that, and so would I, but I just want to interrupt and explain a word that was mentioned, and that was Vox. I want to tell you what Vox is. It's the name of the company that specialises...
One of the big events was when we persuaded Christopher Stone to forsake the BBC and join us. Nowadays, I suppose he'd have been called a disc jockey. But how he'd have hated such a title. He didn't chatter on inconsequentially about anything that came into his head. He had a nice sense of humour, and in his friendly and light-hearted way, he'd comment on gramophone news in general and seriously review or criticise the records he played.
You know exactly how to make the most intimate appeal is built up round you.
That he should have been regarded as a star, as he certainly was in Britain, amazed a prominent radio executive from Paris when I introduced them. Monsieur Christopher Stone, a star? Never. All he plays is the gramophone. You English are quite incomprehensible. But star or no star, Christopher Stone joining us certainly added extra tone to our activities. He was expensive. He cost £5,000 a year, which was a vast salary in those days.
In late 1932, the French government took over Radio Paris, leaving its successful UK broadcasters without a platform. As it turned out, this event coincided with the development of a giant new transmitter in Luxembourg. How Radio Paris became Radio Luxembourg is a fascinating example of clever use of the airwaves as publicity machine.
The presenter who kicked off with Max Staniforth Radio Normandy was Stephen Williams. And he transferred from Radio Paris, which was being shut down, to Radio Luxembourg. He told all his listeners to Radio Paris that they were broadcasting from Radio Luxembourg on the same wavelength as now as Radio Paris. And if they tuned along the dial to the other end of the dial and heard his voice again, they would then know that they were tuned to Radio Luxembourg.
Tune in, for if you want to while away the night or day, I simply say tune in.
The signature tune of pre-war Radio Luxembourg, which began tests in March 1933, starting full transmissions on Sundays on the 29th of October that year. This was a true radio pirate, stealing the long-wave frequency allocated to Radio Warsaw under the recent Lucerne Agreement, brokered by the European Broadcasting Union.
You turn a switch and simply choose, out in the open or right in your home.
The Junglinks to Plateau transmitter blanketed Britain in a way that the first Radio Normandy transmitter never could. And while on Sundays at tea time, the BBC was teaching children how to read an epistle, the brash new kid on the block, Radio Luxembourg, was entertaining families with probably the most famous children's theme of all time.
Letter L speaking, Chairman of the Grand Council of the League of Ovaltinians. I'm sure all listeners, as well as our own League members, look forward as eagerly as we do to this jolly meeting time each Sunday. Today we have a mountain of mirth and a mint of melody for your entertainment.
Well, let's start spending a few notes of melody, Mint L.
Oh, yes. Oh.
Well, here's a jolly good song for jolly good folks to jolly well sing.
Well, jolly well sing it, Es.
All right, I will.
The International Broadcasting Company retaliated by beginning work on a major new studio and transmitter site themselves in Normandy. Growth meant more ambitious programming. The IBC moved to premises further up Portland Place, just about 200 yards from Broadcasting House, and these still remain today. Behind the grand pillars of 35 to 37 is Devonshire Mews and a pub, the Dover Castle, where IBC staff used to drink and plan the programmes. Today, outside number 35, you can still see early double glazing installed when this was a recording studio. Roy Plumley, later famous as the creator of Desert Island Discs for the BBC, got his first job in radio with the IBC. And as he climbed the ladder, took charge of a key part of the expanding empire back in the UK.
This was a development that happened in about 37. We had our first IBC outside broadcast truck, very heavy with a lot of equipment in it, to do what could nowadays be done with a small tape recorder. And then afterwards we had a more elaborate one, and these lorries were put up on jacks, and wax discs were cut outside in the alley. And we'd recorded in cinemas, we recorded cinema organ programs with instrumentalists and soloists, and we used to record specially staged variety programs from cinemas.
This rare recording is interesting in its own right. Radio hadn't yet learnt to let the variety show speak for itself. Here, Roy Plumley is commentating on the occasion, rather as he would at a sporting event.
They're all tall and dark, and they look very much alike, and in this scene, they're wearing evening dress. They're an incredibly versatile bunch of people. During the show, they've been dancing and playing instruments and doing sketches, and now you're going to hear them singing. Two of them, by the way, have got a violin and a guitar.
We had our own road show on the air, a touring review, Radio Normandy Calling, and I used to follow that round. I used to judge the amateur talent competition on Thursday night and then record a half-hour show on Fridays.
And so Blackpool has said goodnight, and we have to thank McLean's Limited for our visit. Good night, everybody. From the whole cast of Lawrence Wright's On With The Show Company and your commentator, Roy Plumley.
And some of the location recordings were made in even more exotic places than Blackpool.
This is Radio Normandy broadcasting on its new wavelength of 274 metres.
David Newman on Radio Normandy in about 1937. David, a remarkably well-preserved 92, is the last surviving announcer from the pre-war IBC. As a young man, he escaped the drabness of 1930s Britain to work on radio in France. For a 20-year-old, as he was then, the time was a great adventure.
It was, because in those days, in 1936, for instance, going abroad was fantastic. People didn't go like they go today. You were actually going on a sort of foreign adventure travel experience, which very few young people of my age had done before. To be able to go abroad at that stage, at that age, and be paid, and work, and enjoy your work, and live in these curious places, was really exciting, and I loved it. And people wrote in, and we were sort of pop stars in those days, and they were sort of writing and asking for photographs, the usual stuff. So we thought, well, this must be rather appreciated. And I didn't consider that we were what my French friend called pirates. A lot of them, people thought, well, we were sort of youngsters over there doing this job, and we were really pirates, and we were sort of doing damage to the BBC. Because there was a bit of a hoo-ha always about Radio Normandy and the other stations. But to be quite honest, I didn't really think much about it. I just did the job. It was completely new, and it was a marvellous experience. And I thought it was marvellous to be able to broadcast and sit in front of a microphone and actually talk, and people know my name and all that. Marvellous. But I didn't really think about the question of whether we were providing a service. I suppose, with hindsight, one could say, yes, we were providing a service which wasn't provided by the BBC. And the programmes were friendly and so on. And we had a children's programme, Uncle This, Uncle That, and so on. The French did the same. So we were known and popular, I would say. But otherwise, I had no sort of feeling of performing a mission to help people sample something different from the BBC. I had nothing against the BBC myself. I was rather admired them. And I went to Paris for the first time by myself, and it was incredible. It was a great eye-opener.
Was that where you first met Roy Plumley?
Yes, that's right. We used to go to the Pam Pam, little restaurant chain in Paris. And then he took me to the nightclubs. Used to go with a microphone like that and sit down at the table. And he had the French ladies who were sort of minor stars for nightclub performers, people who sang songs of rather nice type. And he used to record these, and we used to hear this when I listened. And it was only a short program, mind you. And I think that's about all. He wasn't very onerous, I don't think, but he had a certain amount of preparation and arrangements with all these places, which were, they were chic. They weren't sort of horrible dumps and so on. They weren't clip joints. They were very smart places. And I always remember these beautiful-looking girls who were stars, really, in their own right, in that sort of club circuit. And some of them were, I think, people who made records and were quite well known. And I even remember the names of some of them now, and I think it's impressed me very much.
I've come to a department of the Science Museum, but actually it's a department of the Science Museum in London that many people don't get to see. With me is John Liffen, who's curator of communications at the Science Museum. John, what is this collection here?
We're in the reserve collections of the Science Museum. This is a huge building in Hammersmith near the Olympia Exhibition Halls. It's where we keep much of the material that we can't find space to show actually in the museum at South Kensington.
Well, could we have a look at some of your treasures then?
Let's go.
On either side of us here, we've got racks and racks reaching way up above our heads to the ceiling and full of extraordinary objects from the past, all relating in some way to broadcasting and media and such like, John?
That's right. We're passing some of the earliest Cook and Wheatstone needle telegraphs. We're looking at later machine teleprinters, sounders, printers, Morse keys. And over on the other side, we're looking at radio sets, televisions, recording equipment used in studios. Just, you know, if it's been used in communications over the last 150 years, we may well have an example of it.
One of the things that I notice is the beauty of early precision instruments. It's a bit like looking at surgical instruments, this wonderful glow of brass, and everything is finished in that minute detail. And nice wood, too, as well. I mean, a long way away from the plastic we've come and used to.
That's right. In fact, curators often refer to the brass and glass collections.
This is Sean Davis, who's a recording specialist and actually a former employee as an engineer for the IBC, Captain Plugs International Broadcasting Company. Sean, we've got a couple of devices here that, thanks to John, we can examine that really tell us something about how the programmes got to the listeners, if you like. Because one of the things that's always intrigued me was that whereas the BBC was broadcasting legally from London, the commercial stations couldn't do that. They had to broadcast from the continent. And in order to do that, they had to devise some means of durable and quality recordings. And perhaps this is where we can examine how they did that.
Yes, the problem with the broadcasting from the continent is that unless you've got a very reliable, high-quality radio link, you can't do any live broadcasts from London. So all the programmes were recorded, and they would normally be recorded on discs, and basically similar to the gramophone record production of the day.
Clearly, although they were like the commercial disc, the commercial disc process was a long and quite expensive process. And I think we need to bring in the name of a man called Cecil Watts here, because he's really sort of the father of this technology.
Yes, the problem faced by the BBC in the early 30s and the commercial people as well was that most gramophone recording was done on wax blanks. Now, you could only play back a wax once, and in so doing you damaged it quite a bit. So they were also big and heavy and rather fragile, so it wasn't really a very easy format to use unless you were going to make lots of copies, in which case it went to the factory. They made metal master from it, and they could press out as many as you wanted. Took time, cost money. Cecil Watts was a musician turned inventor, and just about 1930, in Charing Cross Road, he invented the lacquer-coated disc, in which you take a disc of aluminium usually, sometimes glass, and you coat it with a cellulose nitrate lacquer. Don't tell the fire people. And you could actually cut in this lacquer, and it was tough enough that it could take quite a few playbacks without wearing out. This was a lot easier than the wax process, and if you didn't want your program saved for a posterity or whatever, or lots of copies of it, you could cut in the lacquer blank, as it was called, and send that across, and they broadcast directly from it. Unfortunately, the chemical construction of the lacquer is such that very few of those lacquers from those days survive now.
What happened was that they recorded, as you say, in London, and then they were sent over to Paris, and then from Paris they were sent up to us, because I don't think there was a direct mail service which they could have used for speed between London and Fécamp. Anyway, that was the way it was done. So we got all these packets of discs and things, and we had to check them, of course. And they were about, I think, a fortnight ahead, the programs they were recorded, which we had to play. And that was more or less it. So when the programs arrived, we had lots of sort of yellow paper with all the titles and the programs. And we were supposed to be able to translate the titles into French for French announcers, because in the actual studio we always had a French speaker, they called them, you know, in those days they called them a speaker, and he used to sit beside us and then read out all this garbage which we translated terribly badly into French, and they put some sort of corrections in, but it didn't make much sense. But funnily enough, we had quite a few French people in Fécamp who listened to the English record. They liked some of the old-fashioned tunes and Nelson Eddy and people like that. I remember Fred Hartley. Ever heard of him?
I've heard of him.
Yes, beautiful. Much appreciated.
John Liffin, curator of communications here at the Science Museum, we've got a device here which is really an example of how those discs were cut.
Yes, it's a Palmico direct disc recording machine. It's quite massive in construction, very solid steel base with a sort of black crackle finish, a very heavy, large electric motor at the back, and then a device that looks like the conventional pickup arm of old on your record player, but much more massively constructed, with a special type of cutter head which sat on the turntable on which you placed your lacquer disc. And there's a feed screw at the back so as to drive that cutter head across the disc as the recording is being made.
Sean, the issue when you start to convert content to technology, it becomes quite complex, because many of the shows broadcast by the IBC on Radio Normandy and also shows on Radio Luxembourg were quite long. I mean, they were 45 minutes an hour, whatever, some of the, and in front of an audience too. So presumably you get through quite a lot of discs when you're recording a show like that.
Oh yes, you would. And in fact, some people, some places took care of this. The BBC was quite standard that any recording location in the BBC had two machines, not one. Because if you're doing a live show, not a live broadcast, but you're doing a show in front of an audience, and you've got one cutting machine, and something goes wrong, the material cut from the disc is called a swarf, and if that gets tangled around the cutting stylus, you've ruined that side, and then you've got to go on the talk back and stop the comedian in full flight just before his punchline and deflate the audience. Nobody loves you at all. So the best way is to have two machines running, and if the one of them swarfs up, as we call it, then the other one's still running, and nobody knows that you had a disaster.
I only know that the quality of the recording was you couldn't tell whether it was live or not. In fact, my French friend says that he sometimes thought, according to what the French listeners said, that these were live broadcasts from the studio. The quality was so good. And I remember in particular one singer called Morton Downey. And that was a sponsored disc about that size.
About 20 inches across.
Yes, incredible. And that sort of went on for quite a long time, half-hour program, I think. And it was really first-class quality. And people, as I said, they couldn't tell. They thought it was live, these programmes sometimes. Obviously, you had the odd scratch occasionally. You could hear that all right. But rarely.
Lovely lady, I'm falling madly in love with you.
Once again, here is Morton Downey, the golden voice of radio, accompanied by the Green Orchestra. This program of melody and song is sent to you each week by the makers of Dream, the wonderful new Soaply shampoo. Now today, Morton sings a special request number, but here he is himself to introduce it.
One of America's gifted composers is my good friend Nick Kenny, a brilliant young newspaper man of New York. I'd like to sing you his latest hit, which is...
Carelessly, you gave me your...
And of course, this being the Science Museum, we have in our hands one of these very discs we're talking about. John, tell us a little bit about this disc. It looks to me like the sort of 10-inch LP that I remember from the 1950s.
It's not much different, ostensibly. What it is, it's one of the direct disc records that were made by the BBC for war reporting during the latter stage of the Second World War. This was used as a special portable machine that was designed specially for this project. It was known as the Riverside Portable because it looked like the clockwork gramophone that you would take to the seaside in the 1930s.
So this is the sort of disc that people like Dimbleby, Richard Dimbleby and Stanley Maxted, who made that famous extraordinary recording at Arnhem, they'd have been recording onto a disc like this.
Exactly like this one, and indeed you could take this recording machine into the air, and so some of the famous records of bomber raids over Germany were made on machines like that using discs like the one we've got in front of us now.
So the technology that allowed some of the great wartime radio broadcasts by the BBC in large part grew out of a commercial imperative during the previous decade. In fact, the quintessential home of international public service broadcasting, Bush House in London, headquarters for so many years of the World Service, was inherited at the outbreak of war from the huge American advertising agency, J. Walter Thompson. In 1937, JWT had opened a new state-of-the-art radio studio in the basement of Bush House. The claim was that it was the most advanced radio studio in Europe, and certainly the reporter from Noon's Practical Mechanics magazine was impressed at the time.
The recording system has the advantage that the record can be played back instantly. At the opening demonstration, Foster Richmond, the well-known singer, recorded an item which was reproduced through the loudspeakers in the studio almost before he had time to sit down. In addition to a monitoring room, there is a dubbing or editing room, in which are a number of special disc recorders as well as sound-on-film recorders.
But the most revolutionary aspect of the new studio was in its very fabric.
The walls of the studio are panelled in such a way that the panels may be reversed. The one side is quilted to reduce echo, whilst the other side is panelled to provide echo, and thus any desired studio acoustics may be obtained in an instant. The floor is rubber sprung, built on layers of rubber alternating with thick layers of cork to a depth of 2 feet.
Time for a commercial break. We hear a lot about deceiving audiences these days, but here's a dubious attempt at public service broadcasting from Radio Normandy around 1937.
And now, here's another problem letter. A listener writes this to me. Dear Les Allen, I've got the gramophone record you made of Love Will Find a Way. I often play it, but although you sing it so nicely, it makes me feel so sad. You see, the words make me look in the mirror and wish I was so much more attractive. My hair just seems dull and ordinary, and...
Wait a minute, Les. This is one of your letters that I'm going to reply to.
Okay.
I know the right answer. In fact, I've given it in this program already. Let me advise this listener and all the others to write for today's Snowfire free sample, the Snowfire Tinted Wave Set. There's one packed up ready to be posted to you. Write and tell us which shade you want, natural, blonde, auburn, or brunette. It'll make dull-looking hair lovely again. It'll make the setting of your curls and waves easier, natural-looking, and longer-lasting. Let me tell you the address again. Snowfire, Hampshire Limited 22, Derby. Enclose tuppence in stamps for postage, and you'll receive the Snowfire tinted wave set to bring out the natural gleaming tones of your hair.
Thank you.
Actually, I don't think that offer's still open. American agencies were, as the decade progressed, increasingly the power behind the huge success of the commercial broadcasters, making programs which reached a Sunday audience the BBC didn't even try for. And they could demonstrate it through consumer research, something the BBC didn't adopt until October 1936. As early as 1930, voices inside the BBC had been expressing their unease at the lack of information provided regarding listeners and audiences. Val Gielgud, director of drama, wrote,
"It must be of considerable disquiet to many people beside myself to think that it is quite possible that a very great deal of our money and time and effort may be expended on broadcasting into a void."
In 1936, the corporation gave in, appointing Robert Silvey to set up Listener Research. In fact, as Silvey himself recalled in his book Who's Listening, the BBC had actually poached him from a commercial organisation.
"I was in the statistical department of the London Press Exchange, one of the largest advertising agents, and there it fell to me to write the report on a survey of listening to continental stations. The survey showed that the regular audiences for these stations was substantial and increasing."
In a BBC memo, dated October 1937, Silvey wrote,
"From inquiries I have made with advertising people, I believe that the amount spent by advertisers in buying time on continental stations has been approximately 1934, £30,000, 1935, £315,000, 1936, £650,000. It is believed in well-informed quarters that the 1937 figure may be very nearly double that of 1936.
The years 1938 and 39 saw the commercial radio scene reach a high watermark. J. Walter Thompson and other agencies were developing more and more built programs, introducing soap operas from the US like Stella Dallas. They linked radio messages to storylines in Radio Pictorial and other magazines. It was a JWT man who invented the idea of night starvation for a joint Horlicks campaign, one of many in that age of anxiety. This was sophisticated commercial radio that understood audience measurement and how to sell the medium, experience gained through years of successful work in the United States. In early 1939, the organization issued a promotional disc designed to attract UK clients to radio as an advertising medium. It shows clearly the divide in the advertiser's mind as to who would listen to these programs and who would not. The BBC's sometimes been accused of patronizing its audience. But what's interesting here is that for pre-war commercial radio, the message was that the radio audience was something to be exploited.
There's something of importance in the air. The radio department of the J. Walter Thompson Company brings to your ears extracts from its principal programs. Frankly, we know that you, as a businessman, may not find all our programs entertaining. You may say that the selling talks would not sell you. But we ask you to remember that quite deliberately, we have avoided trying to entertain or sell men like you. Most of our programs, like radio itself, are designed specifically for the great middle classes. There's something of importance in the air.
But of course, it was going to be pretty short-lived because in 1939, everything stopped. IBC obviously lost all its broadcasting income. And everyone was put on half pay, a lot of people left, and they had to decide what they were going to do during the war. They had a meeting over at the Dover Castle, a lot of the engineers, and they said they would offer their services to the government, change the name of Radio Normandy to Radio International, and they would broadcast programs to the forces.
Even there is the irony, isn't there? Because even at that point, they beat the establishment to the creation of a forces broadcaster.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah, because the BBC were a bit slow in coming up with the forces station. And, but they did eventually, and of course, Plug lost out because obviously he couldn't broadcast Radio International from this country, so it had to be done from abroad. The Germans overran everything, and that was really the end of Radio International. So it didn't last very long. It packed up in January 1940, and that was the end of it. But it was a good idea at the time. But the other thing that did happen was rather interesting. IBC, in the basement of IBC, the engineers worked on some secret devices. They did produce one, which is rather amusing in a way. It was actually a loudspeaker which was shot from a mortar with a spike on the end of it, and it could be shot over towards enemy lines, and it would land on the spike, and they could then broadcast propaganda to the German soldiers in their trenches or wherever they were. There's a lot of question marks about IBC during the war, which we really haven't managed to sort out. We know that they were classified as a special weapons research unit, but that's all we know.
Meanwhile, the Radio Luxembourg transmitter became a conduit for the ultimate radio pirate, William Joyce, Lord Haw Haw, broadcasting from Hamburg but relayed from Luxembourg. As early as December 1939, 27% of the British population was listening to Joyce on a regular basis, according to Robert Silvey's BBC statistics of the time. In Silvey's words, these sinister broadcasts, with their uncanny ability to show how closely we were being observed and what we were being told, were in a tradition of their own.
Now, although the undeniable and gigantic success of German arms have compelled Mr. Churchill to abandon his attitude of dissimulation and forced him to speak as though an invasion of Britain might take place within a matter of hours, there is still no indication that the British people are fully or even imperfectly informed as to the facts of the military situation. To judge by the BBC bulletins, they have no idea where the front is. Of course, we must not on this occasion be too hard on the BBC. The front moves so rapidly that a pedestrian and disingenuous bureau, such as Duff Cooper commands, can be trusted neither to keep pace with developments nor to impart them to the public as soon as they are ascertained. Whilst new names and places are certainly being mentioned over the British radio, its spirit is still lingering fitfully somewhere in the region of Lillehammer or even Warsaw. The same petty and piteous little devices are being employed to keep the British public ignorant of the true position, even to that very last moment when all knowledge must be useless.
During the war, the BBC proved itself as a public servant beyond all measure, and gradually through those years absorbed change so that by 1945 we had the coming of the light. The light programme grew out of the Forces Service, and the great era of entertainment radio developing from the wartime ITMA on towards Hancock and the Goons through until the late 1950s began. Until a new generation started to notice that Auntie was getting a bit stuffy in the music department, as rock and roll youth began to demand something more up-to-date. As for the indomitable Plugs IBC, after the war, it reinvented itself yet again.
After the war, they became the third largest recording studios in the country, and they were extremely successful, and Plug began making money, a lot of money, actually, and they did produce some programmes, or recorded programmes, for Radio Luxembourg after the war.
Things like the Shilling a Second show, things like that we used to record, and we also became, well, one of the top independent gramophone recording studios. There weren't many in those days. It was mostly done at Abbey Road or Decca in West Hampstead.
But eventually Plug in the early 60s decided that he was running out of money again, because he wasn't very good with money. He tended to spend it rather rapidly, and he did spend a lot of money. So he sold IBC, and he sold it for about £120,000. And he went to Monte Carlo with his son. He had a system, and he gambled, and he lost his money.
Jimmy Young's Too Young was one of our sessions. We did all the Lonnie Donegans. We did the first audition of the Stones. The management turned them down. And we did the first recordings of The Who. In fact, a lot of the great British rock scene was done at IBC, and it became quite a legendary studio, really. People tried to put us to death. Yeah, it was a really, really happening place to be.
And the stations that played that music before there was a Radio 1 or 2 to do so were, of course, the offshore pirates of the 1960s, which is where we came in. So much in history is cyclical, and broadcasting history is no exception. As for Captain Leonard Plugg's Radio Normandy, which had started the whole thing, it officially closed on the 7th of September 1939, 4 days after the declaration of war, with words by Roy Plumley.
And now the International Broadcasting Company's transmission is drawing to a close. To those of you who are keeping watch on board the ships of the seven seas, fair winds and a good passage. To those of you who man the lightships on our sea-washed shores, may your night proceed peacefully, immune from fog. To bakers and newspaper workers, to young mothers who tend their darling little ones, to those who are rising to ashore the early morning ships, may your day of toil be fruitful. And to the rest of you, especially those who may be sick or suffering, good night and happy dreams.
The benediction that listeners on every IBC station had become familiar with at the end of daily transmissions for nearly a decade.
Oh, say, then I'll go, or you'll know that I love you.
God, Pirates and the Ovaltinis, this week's Archive Hour, was written and presented by Sean Street. The reader was Tom Durham, and the programme was produced by Julian May.